He is at this time transporting large armies of foreign mercenaries to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy scarcely paralleled in the most barbarous ages, and totally unworthy the head of a civilized nation.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the America Centrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Today we're going to delve deeper into German connections to the American War of Independence by examining the life of the Hessian officer Johann Ewald. Ewald was born in 1744 in Kassel, which is about 200 miles or 300 kilometers south of Hamburg. He was a professional soldier, a Hessian Jäger commander, who had already amassed a good deal of military experience on the European front during the Seven Years' War, which we've discussed a lot, but he was fighting in Europe in the Seven Years' War, not in North America. In 1776, at the age of 32, he and his elite Jäger troops were sent to North America to fight on behalf of King George against the American Patriot rebels. Over the next couple of years, he fought in a number of battles and learned a good deal about irregular warfare, including guerrilla war, partisan strategy, and insurgency and counterinsurgency tactics. When the British surrendered at Yorktown in 1781, Ewald and his Hessians were among those captured. Since he was an officer, he was released on parole in the dignified European way, and he stayed in New York City until the formal end of the war in 1783. In 1784, 8 long years after his arrival in North America, he was evacuated back to Europe, and he returned to Kassel in April, I believe, of 1784. So those are the basic facts of his life. But what makes Ewald most interesting for us today is that he collected a diary of his wartime experiences in North America. And many, many years later, they kind of came to historians in really interesting circumstances, which we'll discuss later. So our theme today is the Hessian mercenary, or Hessian honorable officer, Johann Ewald. Who was he? How did he find himself fighting in a war thousands of miles away from home? What did he think about the Patriots' desire for independence and freedom from tyranny? And what did he learn about the Americans' irregular military tactics? And lastly, of course, we always wonder what lessons can we learn today by looking at this unique perspective of the American Revolutionary War. My special guest is a world expert on Johann Ewald, Professor James McIntyre. Welcome, James.
Thank you.
James is Associate Professor of History at Moraine Valley Community College. He is the editor of the Journal of the Seven Years' War Association and the author of numerous books about the Revolutionary War, including Johann Ewald, Jäger Commander. He is also the translator and editor of Ewald's monograph published before he left for North America, Gedanken eines hessischen Offiziers über das, was man bei Führung eines Detachements im Felde zu tun hat, which is a wonderful German title for Thoughts of a Hessian Officer on What Has to Be Done During a Tour with a Detachment in the Field. Links to both of these are in the show notes. So let's just start now by thinking a little bit about what I've already hinted at here, that opening passage you read from the Declaration of Independence, describing these Hessians as foreign mercenaries who are being sent to complete the works of death, desolation, and tyranny, already begun with circumstances of cruelty and perfidy, right? Ewald is not thinking of himself as a barbaric killer, is he?
No, not at all. Ewald sees himself as serving his count, the Landgraf of Hesse-Cassel, which was his ambition from early in life. You know, one of his goal was to serve in the Hessian army. And one of the things that comes across quite clearly in his writings, even early on, and the biography his son wrote of him in the early 19th century, he is bound and determined to serve in the Hessian army, And he sees himself as following the will of his, again, his duly ordained leader, not elected, but...
But there's the strong sense of like honor and yes. and legality in what they're doing. I mean, by no respects does he think he is some sort of invading mercenary at all.
Oh, no, not at all. And okay, so what that speaks to is this, you know, since the Declaration, we in North America have tended to look at these German troops that were sent here, the Hessians, the troops from Hesse-Cassel being the largest contingent, as these mercenaries. And there's a certain strand in the historiography in Germany where they're talked about that way. But really, in the 19th century, what happens there, they start to be referred to as subsidy troops. And this is the idea. These smaller German states that are part of the Holy Roman Empire, if you find them on a map from the 18th century, they're kind of sandwiched between the big guys, France, Prussia, Austria. And so they look towards one or the other of these states, or even Britain, to essentially be an ally. And what these different princes had that they could bring to an alliance was their military. And across the 18th century, what Britain had done in these wars with France was they had made these connections with various German states, and their armies kept French troops pinned down in Europe, and the Royal Navy could go along and go around the world and grab French colonies and you know, damage the French overseas empire.
Yeah, so fascinating. So there's this sort of structure already, an accepted structure of what a mercenary is sort of illegally and what a legal mercenary is, and these are more like treaty troops.
Correct. Yes.
But you do pay for them. That's where this mercenary sort of accusation comes in, right?
Yes, you do pay for them, and that's where the mercenary spin can come in. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that, you know, Jefferson was writing a document of strategic communication. He was trying to come up with as many grievances to justify what the colonists were doing as he could.
And certainly foreign infidel mercenary forces rather than sort of legally allied troops coming to help put down an insurrection doesn't play, plays better politically than saying that these are just normal, honorable soldiers coming to do right. their duty.
That would be a funny
line. He is at this time transporting large armies of well-trained, honorable men to support his claim to still be king. No, that yeah. doesn't work. All right, let's go back to now Ewald's youth. There's not a lot to say about it, but let's sort of get us from Ewald's birth to him serving in Europe during the Seven Years' War, please.
Certainly. So, as you mentioned, he's born in Cassel in 1744. Hesse-Cassel is certainly very much involved in these treaties, these subsidy treaties with other states. At the time, they are fighting in the War of the Austrian Succession. And I mention this because he grew up in a town that's the capital. So there's certainly going to be a lot of troops. There's certainly going to be a lot of military pomp and circumstance. And I suggest that that very much influenced him in his earliest days. And among the earliest writings we have is him talking about his desire to be a soldier in, and not just a soldier, but an officer in the Hessian army, which is an important point because he's not a noble. And for the most part, the officer corps was restricted to the nobility. His family is not supportive. His parents actually die in his youth, and his paternal grandmother oversees his education. As he is more and more inclined to join the army, an uncle takes him to one of the early battlefields in the Seven Years' War, Sondershausen, shortly after the fighting when they're still, you know, burying the dead and cleaning things up, kind of scared straight, right? Like, are you sure you want to do this? Because this is what the reality is, kid. And he responds with, oh, how glorious a way to die. And at that point, his family kind of says, all right, we give up. You know, there's no convincing you.
Sorry, that story is interesting for a number of reasons, but I think the first thing that came up, of course, was the kind of common practice of viewing a battle as a spectator sport at the time. Can you just do a little detour and explain that to us? Because I think we find that in 2026 a little bit strange. And I think it has a connection then to the concepts of irregular warfare and stuff versus regular battles, you know, regular battles where you can view them in Europe as a spectator sport, kind of, versus these non-set piece battles where, right, you know, the battle can go anywhere and you can get overrun even though you're just spectating.
Yes. I mean, for the most part, civilians don't tend to be spectators at these set piece battles. They're, because it's a dangerous place to be. They will come shortly afterwards. And, you know, a big part of this is they will, along with the soldiers of the winning side, plunder the dead. They will also help clean up the battlefield and bury the dead. Oftentimes, the commander of the victorious force will go around and impress the peasants from the surrounding villages to, you know, help to care for the wounded and so forth. So it's not like today where the imagery we get of an engagement, you know, a battle is going to be heavily censored. They're not going to show what actually happens to human beings in combat because of the psychological damage it could do. But for the people living in the 18th century, this was very common for them to see just exactly what a cannonball or a musket wound could do to someone.
Yeah, the phrase spectator sport, I was overselling it. The point I'm trying to make is that Ewald's grandfather or uncle could take him to a battlefield.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, like, which is like an interesting day out, we might say.
Yeah, there's no restrictions on it. And again, as I said, right, it's very much a 180 from today where something like that would be cordoned off. People would be kept away. In the 18th century, they were bringing people to the field to help clean it up.
Interesting. Okay, let's carry on then to, so he's now convinced he wants to be a soldier. He is not of the noble class, so he can't become an officer. So he has to figure that out in a different way. And so he does join the Hessian Jaegers and does see battle in the Seven Years' War in Europe, correct?
Well, he actually joins a regular regiment, the Regiment von Gosa, in 1760. And so he serves in a regular infantry regiment in the latter campaigns in the Western theater. So he would be part of what was called the Allied Army under the overall command of Ferdinand of Brunswick, who was Frederick the Great's brother-in-law. He fights at these battles, Wilhelmsthal, Warburg, Fellinghausen, and actually becomes a lieutenant. So, and the big picture, the Seven Years' War consumed officers in really incredible proportions, simply because they were expected to lead from the front. And of course, leading from the front, you expose yourself to much greater danger. One case in point, there's one of the Prussian families in Eastern Europe lost no less than 20 of their male members during the war. Consequently, this window seems to open up where non-nobles who show, and he's educated, he can read and write, which is definitely a plus. So this window opens and some non-nobles of the middle class can get in to the officer corps. Ewald is one of them. He is a very diligent worker, and he is noticed by the upper echelons in the Hessian army and say, hey, this, you know, this is a good candidate.
Okay, and so after he acquits himself well in the Seven Years' War, then he does become an officer, and he eventually joins then the elite corps there.
Correct. In the years after the war, he's posted to garrison duty. He fights a duel in 1770 and loses his left eye. after some rough months worried about what the Count is going to do about this, he is forgiven, and he's actually sent to the Collegium Carolinium, which was a sort of finishing school for these officers, these noble officers in the Hessian army. And that's where he writes his first treatise, which you had mentioned earlier, and then is sent off to the Hesse-Cassel Jaeger Corps and promoted to captain in it as well.
I'd like you to just describe quickly what's important about that first monograph that he wrote about thoughts of a Hessian officer and what has to be done during a tour with a detachment in the field. This is kind of important for later purposes because some of the ideas I think he writes about there, he sees reflected in the strategies that the colonial militias, if not the Continental Army, are using later in the American Revolutionary War.
Yeah, and his own Jaeger. Mm-hmm. What's really striking about his monograph is he will talk about different aspects of what they called at the time petite guerre, small war, what we would today call irregular warfare, right? Small detachments, a company, even a squad going out, searching for an enemy outpost, trying to gain prisoners, gaining intelligence, at times going behind enemy lines, raiding, and generally stirring up confusion behind enemy lines. And in this treatise, when he discusses these things, he does two things. One, he follows the common practice of the day, which was to refer to other previously published military authorities, especially, you know, there's still some of that sort of Renaissance humanism floating around, so referring back to the ancient Greeks and Romans. But what really stands out is he'll also bring in examples from his own experience in the Seven Years' War. At times, and I know at Vallinghausen this happened with his regiment, they would take parts of a unit and actually send regular troops out to act somewhat like irregulars, to raid or go on a patrol and so forth. So he did have that experience previously. He also is bringing up ideas of it would work better if we could do X. And so when he comes over here, he has the opportunity to take those ideas and test them in practice.
That's interesting. And the sort of the dichotomy I'm trying to set up here, and you've said petite guerre, let's use the word irregular warfare now. Sure. Now, I think most of the general population, our understanding of European battles back then is very like these people marching in line, standing together, shooting, and then one side leaves. So very controlled in that respect. That's regular warfare at the time. Mm-hmm. Irregular warfare then is all this other stuff, reconnaissance, sowing confusion, gathering intelligence, capturing prisoners, all of these other things. To what extent was that irregular warfare considered dishonorable at the time? And if we're making that distinction, well, why did they insist on that distinction? Certainly from a modern viewpoint, all that irregular warfare is totally regular, you know?
Yeah, it is a really interesting distinction. And as far as the honor piece goes, I think a lot of it depends on who's doing it, in the sense that if you have troops that are like this really begins during the War of the Austrian Succession. Maria Theresa of Austria is hard-pressed, so she calls on the Pandors and these other irregulars from the southern border of the Austrian Empire with the Ottoman Empire, where both sides practice irregular warfare as kind of a way of life. And she brings these troops into Central Europe, where they're fighting in the Low Countries. Whether or not they think it's honorable, the other belligerents, especially Prussia, recognize very quickly they have to come up with a countermeasure. Where it might not be as honorable, it's certainly very significant for younger officers. it's all over the writings. It's all over the experience. A lot of these younger men who are out to make a reputation will raise up a unit of irregulars. And if it performs well, it's an avenue to promotion. It's a way to get noticed by the monarch, and you can be promoted. Oftentimes it's temporary, you know, what they would call a brevet promotion. However, if again, their service continued to show promise, they might be formally, you know, set at that rank at the end of the war. And so it's seen as a way for officers to make a reputation. Now, then if they fail, they can obviously lose their reputation.
I kind of want to take this tactical distinction of regular and irregular now over the pond to the Seven Years' War in North America, where it seems like irregular warfare is the norm.
Yes. Well, for many of the colonial militia groups, to a large extent, yes, especially those coming from the frontier. You know, part of the Continental Army at its inception were these riflemen that were called up from Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania, and they were seen as frontiersmen. They were seen as troops that excelled at irregular warfare. Why? Because they were fighting the Native Americans very often. And there was some history of this going back through the French and Indian War. And of course, you have people like, you know, Robert Rogers and his Rangers and so on. And so the Jaeger, as well as the British light infantry companies, were seen as a countermeasure to this. It specifically states in some of these subsidy treaties that they want Jaeger, they want riflemen. And the reason was Jaeger is hunter. And mm-hmm. So they actually were part of a guild that was entrusted with maintaining the game on the count or the king or whichever nobles demands, right? Their private hunting grounds. So they were seen as being woodsmen. They were seen as having the sort of skill set that would allow them to compensate when fighting other irregulars in Europe or fighting frontiersmen in North America.
Or in the case of British colonials fighting Native Americans.
Exactly.
Also irregular warfare. All right, so I want to talk about Ewald's orders to go to this new Revolutionary War in the United States, but I think it's important because as we talk about that experience, we'll be going into his diaries, which I mentioned in the beginning. But I think it's important just for you to tell the story of how we now have access to this diary of his, and it's quite a fascinating story.
Absolutely, it is. So Joseph P. Tustin, who was the translator and editor of the diaries, was serving in the American occupation of Germany following the Second World War. And one thing that I think tends to get forgotten is just how devastated Germany was and how that affected the civilian population. People were starving. And consequently, they were selling off family heirlooms and anything they could get their hands on, really, at incredibly low prices just to get enough money to get some food. So one day, a woman comes to the base where Tustin's assigned and has three volumes of this diary. And he, you know, glances over it, looks through it, and kind of recognizes, wow, this is pretty significant.
Yeah, it had never been published or written about before.
No, it had not.
In 200 years or so, 175 years.
Yeah, it really seems like Ewald had written this down, and he did do some editing, some revision later, and that's very clear just from the content of, you know, there's definitely some reflective passages in his diary where it's clear that he went back later on and from some original notes. And what we have is the version where he had gone back and done some of his own editing and said, you know, this occurred to me. And it's clear that, okay, this occurred to you, but it's something that you would only really be confirmed in after the war. At any rate, Tustin purchases these and then recognizes that there's a fourth volume they're out there missing. He does an extensive search. He eventually finds and acquires that in the introduction of his translation of Ewald's Diary of the American War. He is at great pains to make sure that the provenance is clear, that these were legally acquired, they were not looted. But he brings this back to the United States with him and translates it. It's eventually published as a single volume by Yale University Press, comes out in 1979, just past the bicentennial. And since then, it's really been one of the core works for understanding the Hessian perspective and also understanding how the war was fought. Because at the tactical level, Ewald gives you a lot of detail, including even sketches at times of how he deployed troops. So it really gives you that insight, which until then had been kind of lacking.
And also like specific data points too, like I had 60 cannon or 15 light infantry, like really detailed stuff sometimes.
Absolutely.
Appears in there.
You know, or this, you know, I had so many men with me and I was operating with this other officer who had so many men under him and they were posted here and I was posted there and this is how we moved out. You know, he really gives you the nitty gritty details of how his part of the war was conducted.
Okay, let's carry on our story now, and let's just talk about Ewald coming to America in 1776. So, you know, presumably he gets some notification that he's been rented out along with his Jaeger Corps to another war.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work?
So they would form up, he was based in Ziegenhain. And so, one, his company would be brought up to strength, because they usually are under strength during peacetime to save money. And then they would march to ports of embarkation, first in Northern Europe, then sail across to England, where they would form with part of a larger convoy, and eventually come to New York City, where he arrives in the fall of 1776, too late to take part in the fighting on Long Island, but in time to take part in the attack on Fort Washington.
And can you just describe the significance of those engagements?
So what Ewald had already missed was Washington attempting to defend New York City, first by deploying much of his Continental Army on Long Island against the Crown forces under General William Howe. And in August of 1776, the fighting commences with what we refer to as the Battle of Long Island or the Battle of Brooklyn Heights. And Howe outflanks Washington, captures a number of Continental troops. Washington has his back to the wall at the tip of the island. And thanks to John Glover and his Marblehead Mariners, they managed to evacuate the bulk of the Continental Army across from Long Island onto Manhattan in a single night. There's then subsequent fighting at Kipps Bay, at Throg's Neck. These are engagements where the British are using their control of the local maritime lines of communication to outflank Washington and his troops, or attempt to do so. There's only one American victory, which is at Harlem Heights in September of 76. And then the pursuit goes on up to White Plains, where again, the Americans hold their own, but are forced to retreat once again.
And what is Ewald's sort of takeaway from this engagement?
Well, Ewald isn't there for White Plains. So to attempt to control the Hudson, they had built these fortifications, one on Manhattan Island, one on the New York side, right, Fort Washington, and the other on the Jersey side, Fort Lee. And so William Howe doubles back after White Plains to secure his rear area, right, take this fort, which is built at the top of a high ground overlooking part of the island. And Ewald is leading the is part of the Jaeger Corps up this high ground, engaging with the Americans. He is very much opposed to their cause. He sees them as rebels, though he does quickly gain some appreciation of their fighting proficiency as he is coming up against riflemen. So troops who are armed and perform something like his Jaegers. And in fact, at one point in pursuing some, he actually goes too far with a contingent of his troops and is almost cut off until one of his superiors brings up reinforcements and actually comments to him, "Ewald, you say not to do this in your treatise, and then you go ahead and do it yourself." Kind of like, are you paying attention to what you actually wrote, sir?
Mm-hmm. So for me, what's interesting about this story is the idea of sort of established lines, where you know it's Allied territory on one side of this river and enemy territory on the other. There's a lot of confusion here. The British Army could be nominally in control of an area, but there could be lots of partisans or militia.
Absolutely.
Like doing it. So how is Ewald thinking about this? So he went too far, but everywhere is too far, kind of.
Well, and that's one of the sort of dichotomies of the partisan, if you will, right? To establish your reputation, to do good work as a partisan, you're always kind of pushing the envelope. How much farther can I go? Why? Because over this rise, there might be, you know, an unsuspecting detachment of the enemy. Maybe I can nab an officer that we can bring back and get some useful intelligence from. Maybe there are some supplies and I can get those and, you know, my men will have more food, better food, whatever, and their army will be struggling for supplies. So there's always this kind of push on the one hand, and also, you know, when you are successful in those kind of operations and you bring back additional supplies to the main army on your side, this brings you recognition from your commanding, you know, from the overall army commander. Ewald records quite often in his diary whenever he or the Jaeger Corps are singled out by the overall commander. He notes it certainly with William Howe, with Cornwallis, with Clinton, you know, each commander he serves under. And it's very clear from what he writes before and after his pride in that recognition. So that's what he's out to show as an officer, but there's always risk involved, right? You run the risk of being cut off. You run the risk of actually falling into an ambush by irregulars on the other side.
Right. It seems like there are like specific goals of this irregular warfare. One, gathering supplies. Two, reconnaissance. Three, capturing. And I just want to focus on the supplies section. A lot has been discussed throughout the series about the lack of supplies for all sides in this conflict. It seems like one of the central themes of the Revolutionary War is just getting enough supplies to even clothe the troops, let alone arm them and feed them. So, you know, how is Ewald sort of conceptualizing this in his writings?
He does mention it on occasion. He actually notes that towards the end of his first campaign here, towards the end of the 1776 campaign, his men are in rags, and Cornwallis actually provides them with some new uniform equipment. He does not go into detail, and one of the things, obviously, writing about him, I'm curious about, the British are clothed in red, the Jaeger are clothed in green coats. You know, did they get red coats for a time? I suspect they would not have unit pride, but at the same time, you know, new shoes, you know, new stockings, pants, that sort of thing would have been very welcome, especially after conducting the kind of operations they were conducting through the fall and into the early winter. I'm sure they pretty much went through the equipment that they did have.
But it doesn't come up that much in his diaries. It seems like he doesn't then focus on that as much as his his other exploits of reconnaissance and intelligence gathering and maybe capturing.
No, he does not.
Interesting. Maybe we can turn now to talk a little bit about his impressions in his diary of the opposing forces he's facing. And I just have some notes here from his diary. He says, concerning the American army, one should not think that it can be compared to a motley crowd of farmers, which was always the accusation or the disparaging slander that was cast upon the Continental Army and the militias, that they were just a motley crowd of farmers. But Ewald writes, no, that is not the case. The so-called Continental or standing regiments are under good discipline and drill in the English style as well as the English themselves. So what do you make of that comment?
Yeah, one of the things that always struck me with Ewald, which eventually led to me writing about him, is that he is an objective observer. He is a military professional, so he's looking at his opponent, not disparagingly like many British officers whose accounts we get, you know, who look down on the Americans and, oh, we could march across that continent easily with 5,000 troops. Ewald is taking stock. He's going, okay, what are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? And as an irregular operator, he's got to be very aware of the capacity of his opponent, because if he underestimates them, it could be very much to his chagrin when he's operating in the field, because he's going to be operating without support on occasion, you know, unlike the main regular armies. And he is often mentioning the assets. Like, he's often talking about, he's not praising the Americans, but he is saying, look, these are people who should not be discounted. Take them seriously. And at another place, and you probably came across this, he wrote concerning what he found in the baggage of American officers. Right. I found Tilke's field engineer, the instructions of the Frederick the Great to his generals, and I found these more than 100 times. Moreover, several of their officers had designed excellent small handbooks and distributed them in the army. So he's recognizing, like, these are military professionals as well. These are if we weren't fighting, they would be my colleagues.
Yeah. And so they're creating their own doctrine, as all people do, from the research and what has been written before them, plus adding their own experience to it.
Exactly. And Ewald is recognizing this as a good professional should. I mean, he's doing what they call in today in the military net assessment, right? Looking at what are the strengths and liabilities of my opponents.
Right. I found this passage interesting. Again, Ewald's eye for detail is curious. He's watching the Continentals on maneuvers, I think maybe in captivity, and he says, I was greatly surprised that the men were not in close formation, arm to arm, but had consistently left a place for a man between every two men, which is a very good thing in penetrating a thick wood or under brush with entire battalions. I thought that was just such a fine detail. So he's like, well, this is strange. They march very well in formation, but they have this weird angle on it where they keep a man, they skip a man. Every three men, they skip one.
Yeah, and to me, it speaks as, you know, someone who had been used to operating in wooded areas with his troops, kind of going, huh, that's an interesting idea. When I get back to my unit, I'm maybe going to try this and see how this can work.
Another comment here, and this goes to the supply. And I think this is very, very much a praising comment about the American soldiers. He says, the regiments of this army consist of handsome, well-built men whose appearance suffers very much indeed from a lack of clothing, hats, and shoes. For I have seen many soldiers of this army without shoes, with tattered breeches and uniforms patched with all sorts of colored cloth. And then he goes on to say, with what soldiers in the world could one do what was done by these men who go about nearly naked and in the greatest privation? Deny the disciplined soldiers of Europe what is due them, and they will run away in droves, and the general will soon be alone. But from this, one can receive what an enthusiasm which these poor fellows call liberty. So what he's saying here is, like, you know, if we treated our own professional soldiers so poorly, they just leave. And here I see these people who have bested him now officially in the war, serving for an idea rather than for a new uniform.
Yeah. Yeah, that section impressed me a great deal as well when I read it. It's often said that desertion was the mark, the measure of morale in early modern armies. So, and he's, you know, saying if our men don't get their due, morale goes down and they would desert in droves. And they often did in European conflicts at the time. But he's recognizing that this is something different. This is the ideal. And to me, that also speaks to, it makes me think of the words of John Adams, right? The American Revolution was what happened in the hearts and minds of the people before the first shots at Lexington and Concord. There was this change in attitude, and Ewald's picking up on it.
Now, what's hysterical about this passage is in the very next sentence, after saying, wow, yeah, for liberty, these troops will fight with barefoot and without weapons. And in the very next sentence, he says, nevertheless, they are true slaves of Congress and let themselves be led like blind men on a string by these fine heads. For in no monarchy in the world is levying done more forcibly than in this country. Right? I thought that's interesting. So he's not buying his own argument that much. What do you make of that follow on?
Well, I think he's one trying to reassure himself that, you know, this is there are problems, and he does strike on a factual point there, where towards the end of the war, troops were levied in pretty draconian ways a lot of times by the Americans. You know, there were at times people who were convicted of loyalist behavior were sentenced to the Continental Army, which I've always kind of wondered about, like, how good of a Continental would they make if they were loyalists at heart? And at the same time, you know, on one hand, in Europe, most of the time, men had the choice to join. There wasn't that kind of conscription, although there is the incidents at the very outset of the Seven Years' War, when Frederick the Great invades Saxony, and he basically tells the Saxon army, "You're fighting for me now." So he really is kind of trying to reassure himself. I mean, that's the way I take that passage.
Okay. Just took another couple of comments to tie up some things we discussed earlier. We talked about desertion. What was Ewald's experience with desertion with his own Hessian soldiers?
So early on, there's a trend that takes place over the course of the war. Early on, he comes over with an elite unit, people with a very respected skill set who recognize this, have strong esprit de corps. But he even talks about on several occasions in his diary how when they get replacements as the war goes on, the quality is not there and desertion goes up as a result. And his attitude, the way it comes across to me, is he's not shocked by this because he recognizes these troops are not that great material to work with to begin with. And so, yeah, they're not surprising me by running away. It's still something that, you know, for both the practical purpose of military discipline and also his own sense of personal honor, he's certainly not supportive of. You know, it's like he can understand it, but he's never going to take their side.
And generally speaking, the experience of the Hessian and other German Brunswick mercenaries was, you know, by the end of the war, the numbers are pretty grim. And I know it's hard to get exact figures, but what I've seen is that at least 1,200 German mercenaries were killed or died of their wounds. But, and this is, again, going back to, like, lack of supplies, over 6,000 died of, like, illness, accidents and things, not having enough water, food, medical care. And then several thousand did desert. And many of those who were imprisoned, I'm not talking about officers like Ewald, but your average right. soldier decided to stay in the new United States. Do you want to comment on any of those figures?
Certainly. Those who stayed, I think, becomes a nuanced thing, because on one hand, they were prisoners. They may have been prisoners for some time. I mean, if you consider the foot soldiers who were captured at Trenton, they're considered prisoners from 1776 to 1783. And at times, they're going out and working in for farmers in the neighborhood to supplement their diet and supplement their income. There's also the opportunity, and Congress actively tried to get them to change sides, to recruit from them. Those efforts are never hugely successful, and Washington was not a huge fan of this either. At the same time, as the war winds down, every one of those soldiers who came over, including the ones who have been prisoners, in theory, would have to get transport back. And so there is this idea of releasing some of the soldiers, basically to ease the financial stress on the home government in returning. You know, it's like they're going to downsize their military anyhow. That's what they do. You know, we do it when we ratchet down combat operations today. They did it then to save the money from the budget. And so if you're not going, you know, if you have soldiers who would rather stay here than go back to Hesse-Cassel or Brunswick or Anspach, let them.
You know, it's interesting that the experience of the prisoners of war back then varied a great deal, because some could be kept in like brutal conditions and others would kind of just be paroled out far away from any of the fighting to do stuff like work on a farm. And, you know, what are you doing? They could escape. No one's really guarding them that heavily. But there they are out far away. But you could also be stuck on a horrible vermin-infested prison ship.
Well, I mean, the prison ships were more what would happen to Americans taken by the British after, you know, specifically after Long Island and also after the siege in Charleston. There are the prison hulks. For the most part, there's a lot of exchanges between Washington and various British commanders in North America about the conditions the Continentals are exposed to and threatening to expose Crown prisoners, mainly the British, because there's also this idea that, yeah, among the British leadership that, you know, we have these subsidy troops, but the Hessians are kind of their own thing. And I would suspect that while I haven't necessarily seen it written out this boldly, that American leaders, both political and military, recognize that as a vulnerability on the enemy side. You know, we can kind of drive a wedge between the British soldiers and leaders and the Hessian soldiers, and maybe some of the leaders, and take advantage of low morale, though the propaganda that the Hessians often receive of treatment by the Americans, you know, what they could expect if they were captured, is very negative by design. So, you know, so they won't be tempted to just kind of give up and go into American custody.
Okay, so as we said in the beginning, Captain, is he still Captain Ewald
at the end of the war?
Captain Ewald, you know, goes on parole to New York City, and New York City is slowly evacuated. And he does eventually catch a ship back to Europe, and he does return to Kassel. So why don't you just quickly talk us through the remainder of his life and legacy?
Certainly. On his return, he writes a number of additional works on irregular warfare and becomes recognized as something of an expert. In fact, in the following century, Karl von Clausewitz, one of the great military thinkers in the Western tradition, actually in his lectures at the Prussian Kriegsakademie, cites Ewald as one of the key sources on irregular warfare, and basically says, if you want to understand how these small unit tactics work, read Ewald's books. So he has a continuing influence, and he's also picked up on by people in the early 20th century, like the British strategic thinker J.F.C. Fuller, who reads him and says, wow, this guy's ideas on irregular warfare are as fresh today as they were when he wrote them. So
it's his other published books did have traction. It's just what's so special about this diary is that it wasn't in the public domain until this army officer found it. And that's what's one of the many things that's so great about Ewald's story. We're coming to an end now, James, and I always ask my guests to reflect then on the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And so I'm going to ask you to do that. But I want to kind of lead you into this by noting that this is what Ewald says in his Diary of the American War. He asks a rhetorical question. Who would have thought 100 years ago that out of this multitude of rabble would arise a people who could defy kings and enter into a close alliance with crowned heads?
I think Ewald was sensing some of the significance of what had transpired in North America, of the conflict he had participated in. French aid was key to securing American independence, but the idea that here was a new state founded by common people, not members of the nobility, not members of an aristocracy, of a hereditary ruling class, was something that for Ewald, who was born in that sort of society, very much had worked to secure his own upward mobility in that sort of society, found simply stunning, simply amazing.
And what is your takeaway as a historian of this period 250 years later? What should we all remember as we look at the Declaration of Independence 250 years ago?
Looking back, it seems that Ewald really did capture something in that statement, in the sense that not only were these Americans the first ones to establish a modern republic based on republican ideals where no one was of a ruling aristocracy, but that blueprint has been followed repeatedly in the world since.
Professor James McIntyre, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.